When you read Genesis 34, I think it'd be easy to respond with some questions. Questions like, what in the world? What in the world is going on in that chapter? And I think it'd be reasonable to have a follow-up question. Why is that chapter in the Bible? But you might have a question that's a little bit more directed at me this morning. And that might be, and Pastor Kurt, what are you thinking? Why are you preaching on Genesis 34? Why not just punt? Why not just skip it, summarize it, move on to the next chapter that's a lot happier? Obviously, I'm not going to do that, but I probably should at least explain why. We've mentioned many times 2 Timothy 3:16, so I could say that, you know, that not only is all Scripture inspired by God, but it's actually profitable for us. And I could say, well, it's in the Bible, so I should preach it. But what I really need to say, I feel, about why we should talk about this chapter is that it's very necessary for Jacob's story, but it's a very relevant chapter. It's very relevant. And I really kind of, it's curious to me why those that would want to preach only relevant texts, why they would never get to Genesis 34. Because it is. It's relevant. I mean, has anybody been reading the headlines? Has anybody been reading about what's going on in our country? Has anybody followed the last couple years in our country? This text is not talking about anything strange. It's uncomfortable. It's dark. But it's our world. It's the way that it's the world that we exist in. So, what are we supposed to think about this kind of violence? What are we supposed to think about devaluing lives? Mistreatment of women? Are we just supposed to talk about God's solution to it? Or is there a place to give a long, uncomfortable stare at the face of this? What would we be afraid of in doing that? Might be afraid that if we stare directly into this, we might see a reflection of something that's a little bit more familiar than we'd care to admit. No, we have not done the things that you read in this chapter. No, we haven't, hopefully, abused or killed anyone. But are the abusers and murderers as different from us as we tend to think? Or are they actually a reflection of the same impulses and motivations that even as Christians, we continue to battle? So it may be true that in God's grace, we have never acted like Shechem. We've never acted like Jacob's sons. But have we lusted? Have we been angry? Those are the same exact passions that are the source of their actions in this story. The source is the same. It's depraved hearts. That's where this comes from. And that's what this chapter is about. So our tendency this morning, as we look at this passage, is to look at it and think this is just foreign to us. This is foreign to our experience, personally. And we have to be careful not to do that. Because this chapter, it's very relevant, not just to unbelievers, but it's very relevant to us, to our lives, to what we who have experienced God's covenant promises, what we know to be true. Because what you're going to see is it's not just the Canaanites who are doing this. This also is carried out by the people that God has chosen to be his covenant people. So we need to realize that. These desires that we see expressed here, they're the same ones that we're battling. We need to understand that what we see in our world today, same kind of Canaanite desires that we see expressed in our world today, those are the same desires that battle within us, that we're battling against. And we need to see that so we can understand what it is we're actually saved from. What we're being saved from. Ourselves. That's what God's salvation is all about. And that's what we see in this text. So if we want to go back and remember what happened in chapter 33. Jacob had made it back to the land of Canaan, finally, after reconciling with his brother Esau and living a short time outside the promised land in Sukkoth. So he finally enters the land. He establishes this point of contact here at Shechem, just like Abraham had experienced. And yet, the reality is, he's supposed to be going to Bethel. He has a destination he's supposed to be going towards. But he stops here in Shechem. And the way that Moses describes this encampment in verse 18 of chapter 33, he tells us something specifically. He says that the way that Jacob set up camp, he did so before or facing the city. And that sounds a little too close to what we read about Lot in chapter 13, where it says that he pitched his tent as far as or toward Sodom. Probably should be expecting something bad to happen when we read that in chapter 33. So Jacob, he's made it back to Canaan, but Canaan's full of Canaanites. And they aren't the safest people to live around, as we're going to see. And what we see in these verses are three characteristics of these Canaanites. They're driven by passions, they're deceptive, they're vengeful. But they aren't the only ones. So the first thing that we see in these first seven verses of chapter 34 is that the Canaanites are driven by passion. Driven by passions. Now, when you read these accounts in the Bible, in the Old Testament, it's easy for us to shy away from calling them stories. I understand why we want to shy away from that, because we don't want to suggest that they're not true. But we need to bear in mind that the Bible isn't simply recording events. It's also telling us how we should interpret those events. It's telling us how we should understand what happened. So that means that there's an artistry to it that we can describe as literature, as narrative. There's an artistry to it, and the little details that they mention, they matter. And so we want to pay attention to those. Little details, like the way Moses refers to this young girl, Dinah. And how he tells us who she is. He could have just said, this is Jacob's daughter. But by doing it the way that he does, he's reminding us of some of these family tensions and problems. He says that Dinah is the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob. It's important for us to know which mother this is, because we've already seen that really negative favoritism illustrated just in the last chapter. Jacob very clearly favors Rachel and her son Joseph. So from the very beginning, we should recognize that Dinah's not a favored child. She's from unloved Leah. And that probably explains why she has such ease in going out and doing this very risky thing, this risky behavior that she does. When we read that she went out to see the women of the land, we shouldn't picture that as typical of women in these nomadic families. This is not typical, and this is risky, and we see why it's risky in the next verse. She went out to see the women of the land, and someone else saw her. His name's Shechem. His father's Hamor. He's the tribal leader. Hamor is the tribal leader of the region. So he's a ruler. And he's seemingly a significant ruler, because even as far down the road as Judges, the people in the town of Shechem are still referring specifically to Hamor. So he's a significant person historically too. The verbs that describe what Shechem does, they're listed out one right after the other in the original. And that seems to suggest that he's, again, driven by passions. He's just acting in this way. He's acting, it's a swift act, it's illicit, it's coercive. He's doing exactly what his base desires tell him to do. No inhibitions. And he takes advantage of Dinah. And it's terrible. It's reprehensible. He should be made a eunuch and sent to prison for life without parole in the least for what he does. And then it says, it mentions specifically that he humiliated her. And for us, we don't understand the significance of that. We need to understand the lifelong repercussions in Dinah's world. Because women were already treated poorly. I mean, we saw that with the way Laban treated his daughters. He used them to get more labor out of Jacob. He swapped them out. And not only that, he treated them like property, like commodities, because he doesn't do things with the bride price the way that the fathers were supposed to do them. He just spends the money. So like he really did sell them to Jacob. And that's the kind of thing that could happen in their world. And so from the standpoint of many, Dinah would be looked at as damaged goods. Not as many people would be willing to even marry Dinah. She's in a horrible situation because of what he's done. She's been humiliated, she's been humbled, she's been brought to the lowest point. And then this unexpected thing happens. After using her for his own pleasure, Shechem becomes infatuated with Dinah. And again, the verbs are told in the next verse, verse 3, one right after the other. So again, he's still being driven by his passions and doing just immediately the next thing. And what Shechem does in response here, it's really as backwards as people in our day who live together before they get married. If you were to turn back, and you don't have to do this, but in Genesis 2:24, it describes marriage this way. It says that a man shall leave his father and mother, and holding fast to his wife, then the two become one flesh. Shechem reversed it. That word translated hold fast in Genesis 2:24 is translated here in Genesis 34:3 as drawn. Same wording, but the order is different. See, Shechem forced her to be one flesh with him and then held fast to her. It's backwards. Now he does fall for her. And he tries to convince her of his love, speaking tenderly to her. And Dinah is a young girl. She's a teenager, but she is of marriageable age. So Shechem hastily demands to his dad that he needs to arrange this marriage between this teenage girl and himself. And when you read that, I mean, if you're like me, you're thinking, you've got to be kidding me. What father is going to send his daughter off to this deplorable scumbag? I mean, this doesn't make a lot of sense. But given the fact that the position that Dinah is now in, and given the way that women were treated, what potentially Shechem is doing is attempting to do something right, even though it's still terrible, the way that this is going down. He's trying to do the right thing from his very depraved mind. Now, what is Jacob going to do with this? Because, again, he doesn't seem to care about Dinah as much. And, I mean, the way that he responds to Jacob, or to Joseph and Benjamin, what happened to them, I mean, he gets irate. He's very responsive when something happens to his favorite children. But if you look at what he does, it's not much. He's able to stay calm. Keep calm, carry on. He's able to just keep going. He waits until his sons get home. He has a very passive response. And that passivity actually just allows him to kind of exit stage left. He's able to kind of fade out of this story. He only really comes back into play in the end. And the sons replace him. So Hamor's going to come to speak to Jacob, but he's going to end up speaking to Jacob's sons. Now, why would Jacob respond this way? Why would he be so passive about this? Because it's Leah. It's Leah's daughter. And again, this is a very, very negative side of Jacob. So Dinah doesn't matter like Joseph and Benjamin mattered to him. But notice the reactions of the sons. They were indignant. They were very angry. And they have good reason to be angry. In fact, Moses, I think, defends their anger. He describes what has happened. He gives us his opinion, his inspired opinion about what's gone down. Speaking from the standpoint of the audience, he says that this is a serious lawless act. It's an outrageous thing in Israel. Such a thing must not be done. So there's no question about how terrible this is. So it's reasonable for Dinah's brothers to be this upset, this angry. But where their anger goes is not good. And what it reveals is that they, just like these Canaanites, are driven by their passions. It's like they're imagining, when in Canaan, do as the Canaanites. So what we see next, they're not only driven by passions, but secondly, Canaanites are deceptive, and we see that in verses 8 through 24. And what you see in these verses is there's three rounds of dialogue. First, you have Hamor and Shechem talking with Jacob and his sons. And then you have Jacob's sons responding. And then you have Hamor and Shechem talking to the townspeople. And when you compare them, they're talking about very, very similar things. When you compare them, that's when you can tell what's going on in this negotiation for Dinah's hand in marriage. So in verse 8, Hamor makes his case. He makes no apologies. He's courteous, but he makes no apologies for the atrocity that his son has carried out. He just obeys his son. He works on diplomatically arranging this marriage between Jacob's daughter and his son. And he portrays his son as deeply in love with Dinah. And he also portrays this marriage as something that's more significant than just a marriage. See, he's the ruler of the region. So by Jacob's family marrying into his family, he's doing more than just arranging a marriage. He's bringing them into the community. And that's what he's encouraging. He's accepting Jacob and his family as now members of the community. And look at his offer. He's, on the one hand, he's telling Jacob, hey, let's intermarry. Now, intermarriage is a subject throughout the patriarchal stories here. And every time it comes up, it's viewed negatively. So you have Abraham, very specific with his servant, in chapter 24, making him swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. And then Isaac and Rebekah, they get upset when Esau does that very thing in chapter 26 and verse 34. And Rebekah uses that to encourage Isaac to send Jacob away when Esau's going to kill him. And she says to Isaac, I loathe my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women like these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? So what's the problem with marrying a Canaanite? Isaac and Rebekah see problems in lifestyle and problems in that. But God has promised to take this land from the Canaanites and to give it to the Israelites. So how is that going to happen if they become one people? In fact, God has established this rite of circumcision, and it's not a practice that others didn't do, but it's a practice that the Canaanites didn't do, and it was meant to mark off God's people as distinct. They were to be his people. He was their God. They were his specific, distinct people from all the other people in the land. So intermarriage is not what God wanted, but that is what Hamor was offering. And he also offers some things that are very similar to what God promised. He offers to naturalize them, to make them people of the land, to give them rights, changing their status essentially from sojourner to citizen. They could live in, they could dwell there, they could stay there, they could have trading privileges, they could acquire property. And that word he mentions, get property, it's related to the word translated possession in God's promise to Abraham back in Genesis 17. So he's offering, in essence, what God's offering, but he's not offering it in the same way. It's not as good. So Hamor finishes, and Shechem, he can't hold his tongue any longer. He cannot let his dad just diplomatically do this arrangement. So he blurts out this plea, and starting in verse 11, he's telling Jacob's sons, Jacob and his sons, make the bride price as high as you want. Ask for whatever. I will give it if you'll just let me marry Dinah. So if you're thinking about Jacob, again, he has not shown a great deal of concern for Dinah. And this is an offer from a prince, from a ruler. You might think that he would take them up on the offer. But he doesn't say anything. He just lets his sons take over the conversation. He might have known, because he didn't really care as much about Dinah, that they would treat her better, that they would do something better. That might be why he doesn't do anything until they get back. But they basically take over this negotiation. And when Jacob hears what these sons say, I think it's possible that Jacob heard him and thought, wow, that's a really diplomatic way to say no. Hearing the offer that they give, thinking, they're not going to take that up. So he just lets it all happen. The sons, they explain their covenantal status with God, but they don't really tell him everything. In fact, they tell him very little. All they really talk about is this requirement of theirs that they be circumcised. They don't tell the purpose. They don't say that this is supposed to mark us off from the people. This is supposed to show us that we're God's covenant people. It's entrance into God's covenant promises. Instead, they take circumcision and they turn it on its head. They do the exact opposite of what it was intended to do. They use it as a way to assimilate with the Canaanites. They offer to become one people. If you guys do this, we'll become one people. This is not old covenant evangelism. They're not saying you could become followers of the one true God. No, they're just using this in terms of their offer to say we'll become one people if you do this practice. So if you're an Israelite reading this, at this point your jaw's going to drop because of what they're doing. They're doing exactly what God didn't want them to do. They're taking all the languages pointing back to chapter 17 where God instituted this practice of circumcision. And they're taking it and doing the exact opposite, destroying the distinctness of the people with it. So it could sound like a sincere offer, but we've already been tipped off. Back in verse 13, it says, "The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father deceitfully because he had defiled their sister." They have no intentions of following through on this. They have another plan. And unlike possibly what Jacob thought, they're expecting Hamor and Shechem to say yes. We see that as it goes on. They end their talk there in verse 17 with a threat. They say, "But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone." So again, this is the sons of Jacob. So there's a couple details in here that I think point out the situation. First of all, they don't refer to Dinah as their sister. They say our daughter. They have effectively eclipsed Jacob in this negotiation here. But they also say we will take our daughter. So the question is, where is Dinah at this point? You're reading the story and it's natural to assume, oh, she had this experience and then she went home. This is the first hint that she's not home. She's actually being held hostage right now in Shechem. So verses 18 and 19 give the response to their counteroffer. They're good with it. In fact, Shechem is eager to do this. Let's get down, let's do this circumcision. He goes off and does that. And it's at this point we realize just why he is so driven by his passions. Yes, we see this from these older sons of Jacob. They're driven by their passions. Shechem is a teenager. Same word used to describe Dinah, who's a teenager, is used to describe Shechem in verse 19. So he just impulsively goes, gets circumcised. And that's significant because of one more detail there in verse 19. He is the most honored member of the ruling family. So when he does something, it matters. It's going to be influential. It's going to be persuasive. Now, since the offer that really Shechem and Hamor are making is not just about one marriage, it's about this uniting of people groups, that's exactly what they have to do. They have to go and persuade the townspeople, and that's what they do. They head off to the city gate. The city gates, they did not have city planners back in the day, so if you wanted to have a town meeting, you had to find a place for a town meeting. Well, nobody said, I'm going to build my house over here, and you build your house over there so we have space for a town meeting. So the only place a town meeting would happen was at the gate. That was the only place there was room. And so they have this town meeting where the tribal leader, Hamor there, is going to try to discuss this merger between these two people groups. Now, up to this point, I mentioned earlier the Canaanites are deceitful. But up to this point, all you really see is that it's Jacob's sons who are deceitful. But when you look at what the Canaanites say in verses 21 through 23, you can see they're deceitful. They quickly cover what they're offering Jacob and his sons. Their rights to dwell, rights to trade. They conveniently leave out property rights. They don't mention that to the people. And then they stress that there's plenty of room. It's not like you're losing anything. So they downplayed what they were giving away. And then they do something else. There's a subtle shift at the end of verse 21. Back in verse 9, they presented the case as though Jacob and his family are going to be in the driver's seat. They would take their daughters. They would give their daughters. It was Jacob and their family that were the subjects there. And when Jacob's sons respond to verse 16, they say, "We will give. We will take." Now, what you notice, again, in stories, when they repeat dialogue over and over again, this is three times these kinds of statements have been made. And on the third time, it gets flipped. It's not Jacob and his sons that are the subjects. It's the people in the town. They, now, are the ones who will do the giving and the taking. You see, that's subtle. But it was repeated three times for a reason. Moses wants us to catch that little change there to show that Hamor and Shechem, what they're doing in giving this presentation is they're trying to portray it in the best possible way for Jacob first and his family, and now for the townspeople. And not only that, the way that they end this, I mean, they have to convince the townspeople to be circumcised, the men to be circumcised. That's not probably going to be an easy sell. But he's got a closer. You look at verse 23. He didn't say anything like this to Jacob's family. But he says, "Will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us." Now, if you're going to guess between the two groups who Hamor and Shechem have been honest with, I would lean towards them being most honest with the townspeople here. They have every intention of not just taking Dinah, but of also taking everything else. That's the overall plan. And their presentation is successful. And notice, though, verse 24, there's a repetition there, too. Typically, when the Bible repeats something, it wants us to take notice of it. So you notice that the men all agreed. They're all circumcised, but it refers to them in a specific way. It refers to them as those who went out of the gate of his city. It's Hamor's city. And those who go out from the gate are the militia. They're the people who are going to defend the city. They're going out of the gate to battle. That's how that phrase would be used. So, what has just happened? All the able-bodied men have been put out of commission. They're going to be laid up for a while. That's what that verse has just pointed out. That's exactly what Jacob's sons wanted. At least two of them. So the Canaanites are driven by passions. They're deceptive. It's also true that Canaanites are vengeful. But what you see initially here is that Jacob's boys are the ones who demonstrate that. In verses 25 through 31. When in Canaan, they're doing as the Canaanites. Now they don't jump the gun. They wait till that dreaded third day of recovery from surgery. This is a painful time. And the men are doubled over in pain. Now, it is strange that it only mentions Simeon and Levi. We're not sure why it's just them. Reuben is the oldest. Later on, Reuben is not going to be okay with killing Joseph, so maybe he didn't like the idea. But these are the oldest. If you leave out Reuben, these are the oldest. And it could be that's why. They are now taking the lead. They're the ones that are going to go and do this. And that's what they do. They go in and they massacre the town. They kill all the men in the city. And it says that they do that while it felt secure, meaning they knew the fighting men were out of commission. They knew that they didn't have anything to worry about. They go in and they kill all the men, and it seems like they leave Shechem and Hamor for last. And they slaughter them. And then we see very clearly that, yes, Dinah has been held hostage. They take Dinah, and they go. And then they're joined with the rest of the sons. The rest of the sons show up, and on top of killing all the men, they plunder the city. They capture the women and children. They take everything, according to one commentator, they took everything that wasn't nailed down in the city and in the field. They took it all. And in their minds, this is justice. They think this is right. I mean, the passage has been repeatedly saying they're doing this because of what was done to their sister. But it doesn't take a law degree to understand that this is not justice. They have responded to Shechem taking their one woman, their daughter, by killing not just Shechem for doing that, but every single man in the town, and then taking their women and children. That's not justice, that's revenge. And there's no equity in that. So Jacob finally speaks up, but it's not pretty. If you look at the pronouns, listen for the pronouns in verse 30. Jacob tells Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." So he wasn't concerned about the abuse that his daughter experienced. But when it actually affected him personally, then he's very upset. This is, again, not looking at Jacob in a good light at all. What his rant does show is that there was a problem to what they had done. And when I say the Canaanites are vengeful, that's what Jacob is saying. When Jacob's sons went in and did what they did, they were playing the Canaanite game. This is what Canaanites do. They're going to be vengeful. They're not going to just let this small family of foreigners massacre a town. They're going to mobilize an army. They're going to try to wipe them out. That's what you would expect. Playing by their game is going to burn you. So the thing that you see, though, in the passage is that there's no difference between these two peoples. Both of them are vengeful. Both of them are driven by passions. Both of them are deceitful. As deceitful, as driven by passions, as vengeful as any of the Canaanites. So there are major problems that this passage brings to light. First of all, it does show that the Canaanites are dangerous people. You just have to look at what they do to Dinah and understand. They are not safe people to live around. They're not good. But neither is God's people. Neither are God's people. When they're in Canaan, they do as the Canaanites do. Why? Is it just a bad influence? No. Why did God choose this group of people? Was it because they were righteous? No. What Moses says to the people in Deuteronomy 9:6, it could easily have been applied here to this scene. Moses tells the people in Deuteronomy 9:6, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people." The sons of Jacob, they look like Canaanites. They look like Canaanites because they're just as depraved as Canaanites. So how do we make sense of this? How do we make sense of a story like this? What are we supposed to do with it? This is what God is rescuing us from. It's not just from the evil out there. When God saves us, he is rescuing us from the evil that is within us. evil that's there because of our separation from God. So no, we don't express things all in the same way. You know, God's grace impacts us all differently. It protects us all differently. So not all of us would have acted in these ways. But understand, given different circumstances, we possess the same depraved hearts that are capable of acting like Shechem, acting like Simeon and Levi and Jacob's sons. So at times we could look down on people around us. We could look down on people in history. We could look down on those who do horrific things and think, I could never do that. By God's grace, maybe not. But if God did not show you that undeserved kindness, we have the same hearts as the people who have done those things. What this text shows us is that the patriarchs weren't inherently good. And neither are we. Deep down, we have the same heart problem. It is nothing but God's grace that keeps us from things like this. So, it's easy to not want to look at a passage like this because of how unpalatable it is. It's easy to want to avoid it because it's uncomfortable. But it's real life. It's these kinds of things that spawned the Me Too movement, that spawned Black Lives Matter. These depraved reactions, this is where misogyny and racism come from. Depraved hearts. And the first step for us to address things like these in a theological way is to recognize, to realize that the evil is ours by nature when we were separated from God. Passages like these should keep us from doubting that we've been impacted by the things that our society has been impacted by. It should keep us from thinking that we're above the things that we see in our world. If we struggle to see ourselves like the people who mistreat others around us, we struggle to do that. It's because we've drunk the Kool-Aid that our society has been handing out for a while now. Our society is struggling right now because they've been telling us over and over again that we're inherently good. And these things just keep happening, being brought to light. We aren't basically good. Without God, separated from God, it is impossible for us to be good. Yeah, we can do good things. That is possible to do good things by God's grace. But separated from God, we cannot be good. Cannot change the warped hearts that have been destroyed when we were separated from God. Our hearts do not function. Our human hearts, our human personalities, our human existence doesn't work right once we are disconnected from God. And we can't change that other than being reunited with God. So if you've been watching the news, if you've been paying attention to what's going on, you're trying to figure out what to do about it, the first thing that we need to do is recognize the evil within us. We haven't done some of these terrible things. You might not have done those terrible things. But the first thing to do is to recognize that you have the same, by birth, you would have the same human heart. Never meant to be disconnected from God. Capable of doing terrible things. You need to recognize your need to be reunited with God, that you cannot just go on and live life on your own. You need to turn from the lie that our society has been telling us, that you are inherently good. You need to recognize that that's not true, that the Bible is true. Romans 3, 10 through 12 says, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they've become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Not me, not you, naturally, we are not good people. So we need to put the Kool-Aid down. We need to turn from just living life the way that we think is best. We need to look to God to rescue us, turn back to God. How do we do that? We turn and we trust in what Jesus has done to save us. We trust in the salvation that he provided by coming, living, dying, rising again to provide forgiveness, to bring us back to God. And we turn from living for ourselves and we trust that we believe that Jesus came and died for us, rose again for us, for me. And then we start listening to him. We join his people. We listen to his word. And he gives us his spirit to begin to love the way that we were meant to love. Now, if anybody has any questions about that, I would love to talk to you. I'd be willing to talk to you. So come and talk to me. We can talk outside if you feel more comfortable with that. But what we don't want to do then is to be dismissive of attempts to improve the situation. We don't want to say, well, since Christ is the only solution, all I need to do is pray and witness. Certainly, pray and witness. But understand that we still battle against these kinds of desires, these kinds of passions, things that look bad outside of God's grace. We still battle those. We've been changed. We have been made new creations, but the sinful desires remain. Those sinful desires, they're battling against our soul. They don't want us to love the way that we were made to love. And we have to battle those in an ongoing way, which means that we can be influenced. That means that we can be doing the same kinds of things. Our thinking can be incorrect. It can be wrong. It can think about others wrongly, and it can treat others wrongly. Just because you're a Christian doesn't mean that you can't be capable of mistreating others. And so right now, what that means is we should be listening to the people around us because we know the problem. We recognize what we've been saved from. We recognize the dangers that are still there within our hearts, and we should not be dismissive. We should not say, I don't need to listen to this. I don't need to worry about being that way. I'm not that way. I'm not racist. We have the same depraved hearts that produced the KKK, that produced slavery. We have been saved by God's grace, it's true. There is a new creation existence, but we still have the same sinful desires at work. We still have the flesh. And that means that we can still act in these wrong ways, and we need to listen. We need to listen, especially to people that are different than us, who have a different experience, that could maybe help us see some blind spots, because there are blind spots. There are always going to be things that we don't realize we're doing. And we should not be dismissive. We should be willing to listen. To listen to your brothers and sisters in Christ who are different, who have a different perspective. You may not agree about what the solutions would be, but listen. You might think about things differently. You might recognize some areas in your heart where you are not loving the way that you're supposed to be loved. Truth is, sometimes we don't realize how we're acting towards God and others. And I didn't mention last verse in this section, but if you look at that verse, verse 31, Jacob's sons, they justified their actions based on how their sister was treated. And they portray it in this specifically poignant way. Shechem, the way that they describe this, Shechem used Dinah, satisfied his own desires, and he thought he could make it right by paying off the family. He thought he could pay for it. Use the person, and then pay off. Why would that be the last word in a story like this? That's very deliberate. Might be because Jacob has been acting that way towards God. That is, after all, what his vow was. God, you satisfy my desires, and I'll pay you with a tithe. Maybe why he doesn't get the last word, because that shut him up. And maybe why he does what he does in the next section. When God tells him to go to Bethel, not only does he go to Bethel, but in verse 2, he gets rid of the other gods. Now, he understands that he needs God, but he's understanding that he has more to repent of. There are things that we can do, ways that we can act, and we don't even realize how bad it is. I think that illustrates it for us. And that's why God brings us together again with other people, other believers, so that other believers can come alongside us and point things out that we're not going to necessarily see for ourselves. And that's why it's good to get to know, again, other brothers and sisters in Christ who aren't necessarily coming from where you're coming from, so that you can see life differently. That's also a reason to read church history, to read from people from different times, to get different perspectives, so that we can recognize some of the blind spots from living in our time, living where we live. It's not wrong to live where we live or in our time, but we're not going to see things as well. So we need people to point things out to us. There is some good news, though. I do want to end with this good news from this chapter. It's the same good news we should see as we're reading Genesis. Because the story starts off very good. And then it veers off very badly, right up from the start. But what you see throughout, all along the way really, is God is still at work to accomplish his plan. And he doesn't change. He doesn't veer from that. He interacts with people. He punishes. He does things. But he continues his plan from the beginning to fill the earth with image bearers and to bless them. That's been the plan. That continues to be the plan. And it's the plan in the context of sinful people. Understand the end result. It's all leading to Jesus. Jesus is the only one who is sinless, the only one who is perfect. How is God's plan going to work if he's got to work with sinners? That's what we see. That God doesn't wait for us to figure things out. That God doesn't wait till we clean ourselves up. That God, in his amazing sovereignty, in his amazing providence, is able to work with and through sinners to accomplish his blessings, his promises, his plans. And that should be encouraging. Things aren't out of control. Even in a dark, dark place, God is still at work. God is able to accomplish his plans. He's already done that at the cross. So remember, the cross was God's plan from before he created the world. And yet, how did it come about? Through the hands of sinners. So, what that means is that there is hope. In the midst of chaos, in the midst of darkness, in the midst of the problems that we face, the God who started this work, started this plan, he is able to finish it. Even when we're in Canaan. Join me in prayer. Father, I recognize that I have blind spots all the time. That one of the gifts of marriage is having somebody being able to walk closely with you, to be able to point those out. Ways that in my sinful desires, my sinful fleshly desires want me to think the best of myself. And I overlook the ways that I'm not treating others the way that I ought to. So, Father, I pray that you would continue to open my eyes to the ways that I am not loving like Christ loves. Pray that you would do that for our church, that we would be a light that is distinctly different from the world. That we would not, on the one hand, assume that we're perfect, but that we would rely on your grace, that we'd rely on the Spirit that you've given us, to know that you are at work making us more like Christ, that we would want that to happen, that we would show evidence that we want to do that by listening to how we can grow. And I don't have answers. I don't know what exactly the solutions are to dealing with the problems that we face today. But I do know that I'm not perfect, that I'm still pursuing this knowing Christ, like Paul tells us to do in Philippians. I still need to not look back, but look forward, to continue to make progress, and I want to do that. And so I pray that, Father, we as a church would want to do that. That this snapshot of depravity here, what you're saving us from, that we would be able to realize the danger all the more clearly. We would be able to depend on you all more humbly. And that we would know that you are at work. Father, I pray for the person listening who thinks they are a good person. Doesn't think that they are really that bad. Because of your grace, really. Because you have kept them from expressing their heart the way that they could in different circumstances. I pray that you'd open their eyes to that. Your Spirit would open their eyes to the good news. That they would turn from living for themselves, and that they would trust in Jesus. I ask all this through your Son.